Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, February 18th, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Dove, and glad to report to you today that we're at 5 and warming up. So keep going, weather. We're sunny with some clouds. The front page of the Courier today, our headline reads, Idle Interrupted. The article is accompanied with a picture of Maddie Poppy, who will perform a trio of acoustic shows during the annual Eastern Iowa Sports Show on March 12th through the 14th in Cedar Falls. Virus pushes pause on Clarksville Native's burgering career by journalist Melody Parker. Clarksville. Maddie Poppy has changed. For one thing, the blonde has gone brunette. I just got bored with the same old, she said with a laugh. So she changed her hair color and went from light to dark. And it's been 3 years since Poppy captured hearts as the winner of season 16 of American Idol. Anyone who goes through that situation, it's such an overnight change. There's no rule book. You have to figure things out for yourself, she said, admitting, I used to be more naive. Now, at 23, the singer-songwriter has become a confident, strong woman. I've learned that I have to stand up for myself and make choices for me, what's best for me. That's something you learn along the way. The coronavirus pandemic has kept her close to her Clarksville home. Although she has performed and ventured to Nashville to see her boyfriend, Caleb Lee Hutchinson, her idol runner-up, last year the couple also took a trip to the Grand Canyon. For the past couple of years, it's been go, go, go. I've been gone for a month or so at a time, then with family for 3 days, and then gone again. That's the lifestyle because of the career path I've chosen. It's been so nice, honestly, to be with my family, Poppy said. Poppy will perform a trio of acoustic grandstand shows during the annual Eastern Iowa Sports Show on March 12th through the 14th. The 46th annual sports show takes place at the Unidome in Cedar Falls. Her shows are at 6 p.m. on March 12th, 4 p.m. March 13th, and 1 p.m. March 14th in the nearby McLeod Center. She grew up playing guitar and ukulele. Playing acoustic has been fun, way more laid back, but I miss playing with the band, and that's definitely a change. Because I used to be into the acoustic stuff. That's the only kind of music I wanted to play. Now I miss playing off the band, having them there and interacting with the live audience. She hopes to reconnect with area fans at her sports show performance. Seating is limited to 700. There's no additional charge to attend a show with the price of sports show admission. Tickets can be purchased at www.iowasportsshows.com. As her career continues to evolve, Poppy has learned to think outside the box. I felt intimidated when I got into a room with other writers and peoples who'd say, we want you to do this song. I'd think, I don't like that song. But when it was done, I'd really like it and be glad I took the chance. I was super hesitant about taking on other styles of music, but I'm glad I did. Since the pandemic, Poppy has presented live virtual shows and made limited solo acoustic appearances, in particularly during the holidays, to promote her first Christmas EP, aptly titled Christmas from Home. She played two sold-out limited audience shows in the Great Hall at the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center and a virtual concert at Hawkeye Community College. Poppy won American Idol in 2018. Her album, Whirlwind, reaches number 2 on the iTunes pop chart, and her single, Made You Miss, reached number 19 on the Hot AC radio charts, while her ballad, Not Losing You, charted at number 17. In 2019, the singer joined the dramatic tour with Ingrid Michaelson performing throughout the U.S. Before her Idol rise, she released her debut album, Songs from the Basement, in 2016. She wrote, produced, and recorded the record with her father, Trent. She unsuccessfully auditioned for The Voice, but the experience gave her confidence to later audition for American Idol. Poppy has appeared on multiple TV shows, including Live with Kelly and Ryan, and the Radio Disney Music Awards, and played at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, the Special Olympics, and CMA Fest in Nashville. She has been writing songs in her downtime. That's second nature, although she has missed collaborating with other writers. Disappointed that she couldn't go into the studio and record any new music to release, she opted to record an EP featuring Christmas chestnuts, including her favorite, It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year. Like many people, Poppy never expected the pandemic to last as long as it has. I thought by last summer we'd be done with it. I'm looking forward to live shows starting again. Everyone's kind of over the virtual shows. Poppy admits that she's been pretty bored at times, even enough that she's been tackling some do-it-yourself home projects. I'm at the point that I'm learning to tile floors, doing a lot of painting and putting on window trim, she added, laughing. Good luck to Maddie Poppy. All right. Our next article from the front page of the Waterloo Courier, the headline reads, Vaccine Cost-Free, but providers may still ask questions. Clinics may request insurance info ID. Journalist Sydney Kreisen, Waterloo. Residents won't have to pay out of pocket for COVID-19 vaccine, but area healthcare providers often ask people for their health insurance. Three of four major healthcare systems, including Mercy One, Unity Point, and Waverly Health Center, said they asked people to provide their private insurance or Medicare and Medicaid coverage. The systems said they charge insurance agencies for administration fees, which cover the cost of staff doing vaccinations. But people without health insurance can still get the vaccine for free, the provider said. They will not get billed administration fees. Healthcare providers can get reimbursed for administering the vaccine to uninsured people through the Health Resources and Service Administration's Provide Relief Fund, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. No one can be denied a vaccine if they are unable to pay for the vaccine's administration fee, the CDC website says. Heidi Solheim, Chief Operating Officer at Waverly Health Center, said available insurance information must be documented to meet requirements by the Iowa Department of Public Health and the Department of Health and Human Services. Unity Point requires people to provide their driver's license or other form of photo ID, said the spokesman, Carson Tiggs. He said the requirement ensures the patient's medical record and other databases are updated and accurate. Adam Ador, spokesperson for Mercy One, said the system similarly requires photo ID. He said it also asks people to verify their age, whether 2 weeks passed since they've received a flu vaccine, and whether 2 weeks passed since a close exposure to COVID-19. People are also asked if they had any household contacts with COVID-19 or attended any unmasked events. Residents who had COVID-19 are asked whether it has been at least 90 days since they got an IV infusion treatment for the virus. People's Community Health Clinic, a federally qualified health center, said it does not require any documentation for people to get the COVID-19 vaccine. Spokesperson Augusta Sires said the provider has people fill out brief health histories and consent forms before getting vaccinated. Mercy One, Unity Point, Waverly Health Center, and People's Community Health Clinics are vaccinating both patients and non-patient, spokespeople said. Mercy One is giving COVID-19 vaccines to patients of independent medical providers and people who are not affiliated with healthcare providers, Amardar said. Unity Point is similarly giving vaccines to patients of private and independent medical centers and other people eligible to get vaccinated, Tiggs said. Waverly Health Centers will still work to vaccinate eligible residents who express interest on an online form, Solheim said. This includes both patients and non-patients. People can also contact the center by phone at 319-352-4120. We are working very closely with the other healthcare providers in our county health department to cover as many eligible individuals as possible, Solheim said. People without healthcare providers can call the Blackhawk County Health Department at 319-292-2360 to schedule vaccine appointments. Good luck, listeners, on getting your vaccine. Okay, our next headline on the front page of the Courier is GOP slashes early voting. Mailing applications for absentee ballots also would be banned. Ryan Foley, Associated Press, Iowa City. Iowa Republicans-controlled legislature advanced a bill Wednesday to significantly limit voting by mail and early voting, threaten criminal charges against county auditors who depart from state election guidance, and remove many inactive voters from the rolls. The far-reaching bill would cut the mail and in-person early voting period from 29 to 18 days, after Republicans whittled it down from 40 days just 4 years ago. It would bar counties from mailing absentee ballot applications to voters, tightly regulate how absentee ballots can be returned, and potentially cut many more voting locations. Republicans praised the bill during a Senate subcommittee hearing one day after its introduction. A House subcommittee was scheduled later Wednesday to consider the bill, which follows an election in which Iowa Republicans swept major races and that both parties said went smoothly despite the coronavirus pandemic. Democrats and voting rights activists called the changes anti-democratic and intended to cement the GOP's growing dominance in Iowa through voter suppression. GOP Senator Jason Schultz said the changes address shady dealings in heavily black cities in swing states where voters helped President Joe Biden defeat Donald Trump. He repeated the false claim that election fraud cost Trump the election, which Trump lost by 7 million votes and 74 electoral college votes. When you don't strengthen your election system, you allow people to game elections in cities such as Philadelphia, Schultz said. The Iowa State Association of County Auditors, which represents elections commissions in 99 counties, warned the bill would take away local decision-making, threaten severe penalties against election workers who make mistakes, and increase their staffing needs and workloads. Voters would see longer lines at polling places and on election day and at the remaining early voting sites, said Ryan Dorker, a Republican who is the group's president and auditor in Sioux County, a GOP stronghold. But with Republicans controlling the legislature and governor's office, the prospects of stopping the change appeared slim. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds signaled she was open to reducing mail and early voting opportunities, calling the current 29-day window a long period of time. Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate, the state's election commissioner, said he respects the legislature's role in writing elections law. If they seek re-election, Pate and Reynolds will be on the ballot in 2022, when the new rule would be in effect. A record 1.7 million Iowan voters participated in the 2020 presidential election. 76% turnout and no major allegations of fraud have surfaced. With many seeking to avoid COVID-19 exposure at the polls on Election Day, 1 million people voted absentee by returning ballots through the mail, dropping them off, or casting them at early voting. More than 80% of registered Democrats and 54% of registered Republicans who participated in the election did so through absentee voting, according to Iowa Secretary of State data. While Democrats won early voters, Republicans dominated among Election Day voters. Under the bill, county auditors could not mail ballots to voters who had requested them until mid-October, before a general election. Voters would have to drop them off by Election Day or put them in the mail the day before the election in order to count. Each county would be limited to one ballot drop box, which would have to be under video surveillance. Only voters themselves, their household members, or caretakers could return ballots, which would criminalize doing so by friends, neighbors, or organizers. Auditors would be barred from mailing applicants for absentee ballots to voters, a practice credited with increasing participation during the pandemic. Instead, voters would have to obtain and submit applications themselves beginning 70 days before the election instead of the current 120. Counties would offer early voting during the 18-day period at their offices, but would no longer have authority to set up satellite voting locations in places like libraries and college campuses. Specific locations would be allowed if 100 voters signed a petition requesting them. The bill declares the auditors do not have home rule power to run elections, a principle of local control in the Iowa Constitution. Instead, they would be required to follow guidance from Iowa's Secretary of State, currently Pate, or be charged with felony election misconduct. Precinct or county officials could also face charges for interfering with election observers. The secretary would be required to fine auditors up to $10,000 for any technical infractions issued to counties that do not comply with state law. The state could have workers observe counties for 60 days before elections to look for violations. Pate, last year, reprimanded three county auditors for defying his guidance and mailing absentee ballot applications to voters that were pre-filled with personal information, such as addresses and dates of birth. Trump's campaign sued to invalidate those applications, which required thousands of voters to submit new requests or vote in person. Linn County Auditor Joel Miller, a Democrat, and the elections commissioner in the state's second largest county called the bill vindictive. It's an affront to every county auditor in the state with a passive passion for creativity, election integrity, and increasing voter turnout, said Miller, who was among those reprimanded by Pate. The bill also would take several steps to remove voters who move, die, or do not participate in elections from the voter registration list. The state could hire outside vendors to identify ineligible voters on an ongoing basis. This current session has been active. Let's go ahead and look for some other news. In the Cedar Valley, Cedar Falls tax rate falls, bills going up. Budget for the next fiscal year crosses 100 million mark. Amy Rivers is the journalist, Cedar Falls. The city's budget for the next fiscal year crossed the $100 million mark with capital improvement projects and Public Works Department representing the largest portion of the city's expenses. The city council voted 6-1 with an at-large councilman, Dave Sires, dissenting to approve the fiscal year 2022 budget, which runs July 1st of this year through June 30th of 2022. The tax rate, at roughly $11.38 per $1,000 of taxable property value and $3 on agricultural land, is lower than last year's by a few cents. but the state is raising the percentage of property value used to calculate tax liability for residential homeowners, known as the rollback. When you couple that tax rate with the rollback factors, that will actually result in a 1.98% increase on residential, a 0.44% decrease on commercial and industrial, and a 5.98% decrease on multiple residence property, said Finance Director Jennifer Rodenbeck. The total budget for the city will be $101,752,860, with an estimated $82,128,090 in revenue and $88,416,510 in expenditures. A little over $24.7 million of the expenditures is budgeted for capital improvement projects, an increase of around $5 million from fiscal year of 21, and the largest single expenditure in the budget. Sires said he understood the state rollback was something the council couldn't do anything about, but he questioned why there weren't more cuts to the budget to keep from increasing residents' tax bills. I believe we should have priorities, and during a pandemic time, it would have been nice to have priorities so that we could save a little money and not pass it on to our residents, he said. The largest expenditure jump year over year was from the Public Works Department at an estimated nearly $21.4 million, significantly more than the $13.7 million estimated spent this year. The largest portion of that department's expenses annually are related to roads, bridges, and sidewalks, and the city is looking to undertake large street reconstruction projects this year, including the second phase of a nearly $3.8 million downtown streetscape project and a smaller sanitary sewer project that both passed the council's unanimously Monday night. The streetscape project, civil engineer Ben Claypool said, will fully reconstruct East 3rd Street and two blocks of 4th Street from Washington to State Street, conduct a full restoration including curb and clay brick pavers on West 5th Street, and add pavers, benches, and plantings to Main Street from 3rd to 6th Street. It will be funded with tax increment financing from the downtown district, as well as funding from Community Main Street, the Blackhawk County Gaming Association, and Cedar Falls Utilities, and is expected to be constructed during the 2021 and 2022 construction season, Claypool said. The sanitation sewer rehabilitation project, which will add cured-in-place lining within existing sewer lines in selected areas of the city, will cost just under $242,000 and be funded by the Sanitation Sewer Rental Fund, said civil engineer Matt Tolan. All right. Another article in the Cedar Valley section of the newspaper for Thursday, February 18th, is Vaccine Incentives Offered at Tyson, by Sydney Krizen, journalist. Waterloo. Tyson workers in Waterloo could get up to 4 hours of regular pay for getting the COVID-19 vaccine, the company announced Wednesday. Tyson is offering COVID-19 vaccines to workers at its own clinics with Matrix Medical Network, the company announced in January. Workers have the option of, instead of getting vaccinated through an external source, such as their healthcare providers or pharmacies. Tyson officials called the pay incentive a way to further encourage workers to get vaccinated. Members of the Waterloo plant's health service staff already got vaccinated, the company said. The rest of its workers will be offered vaccines as they become available. Tyson employees vaccinated on site before or after their shifts will have the time added to their worked hours, the company said. Employees vaccinated by outside sources will need to show valid vaccination cards to be paid for 4 hours of time. We are ready to vaccinate more of our people, especially through the free on-site vaccination program we've developed. However, vaccine availability continues to vary by state, said Johanna Soderstrom, Tyson Executive Vice President and Chief Human Resource Officer. Workers are not required to get the vaccine, Tyson said. The company strongly encourages it. Waterloo Tyson workers fall into the state and county's current priority group. The Blackhawk County Health Department plans to vaccinate them in the second tier of the group, after first responders, K-12 teachers, and child care workers. The county began vaccinating teachers in the past week. The company said hundreds of its U.S. workers are already vaccinated, primarily those who work in health services or are 65 or older. It expects 1,000 more workers in Illinois, Missouri, and Virginia to get the vaccines this week. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, February 18th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Donald E. Lehman, October 1, 1938 to February 15, 2021. Iowa City. Donald E. Lehman, 82, longtime area educator, died Monday, February 15, 2021, at the Bird House Hospice Home of Johnson County. Funeral services will be held 11 a.m. Friday, February 19, 2021, at St. Andrew Presbyterian Church in Iowa City, where there will be a time for visitation 1 hour prior to the service. In lieu of flowers, Don's family encourages memorial donations to the Bird House Hospice Home of Johnson County to continue to support the compassionate care they provide for Don and his family. To share a thought, memory, or condolences with his family, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandcheetah.com. Donald E. Lehman was born October 1, 1938, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Paul and Susie Kelly Lehman. Following graduation from high school in Waterloo, he attended and received his B.S. and M.A. degrees in education from the University of Northern Iowa. Don married Vera Jane Steele on August 12, 1962 in Waterloo. The couple had been sweethearts since high school, and like Don, she also received her degree in education from UNI. Don's long career in teaching began in Newton, Iowa, where he taught for 7 years before moving his family to Iowa City, where he taught in the Iowa City Community School System for over 30 years, before retiring in 1998. He taught mathematics at both Northwest Junior High and West High School during this time, a career that he cherished and developed lifetime friendships with his students and fellow educators. His wife died February of 2006. Don was blessed with a second marriage to Mary Margaret Hunt on October 19, 2008. Don enjoyed so much in his life. First and foremost was his family, friends, and students. He had always appreciated the outdoors, an avid fisherman, hunter, and golfer. He and Vera shared the love of dancing, and this is where he met Mary Margaret after Vera's death. Dancing. He was a member of St. Andrew Presbyterian Church, Elks Clubs, Lions Club, National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, Iowa State Association of Math Teachers, Kappa Delta Lambda Honorary Science Fraternity, the University Math Club, and of course his dance clubs. East Central Association of Square Dance and Round Dancers, and the Round Dance Association. Don was never bashful about giving back to those around him, often stepping up in leadership roles to support what was important to him and those he cared so much about. A quiet, quick-wit sense of humor wise with wisdom, intelligent but very down to earth, very loving man that loved and was loved by all who knew him. His family includes two daughters and their husbands, Donna and Jeff Aubrey, and Ellen and Reverend Dr. Tim Stidham, grandchildren Ryan Aubrey and Hannah, Brandon Aubrey and Jen, Sarah Stingheim and Rachel Stingheim. Don was preceded in death by his wives, Verrill and Mary Margaret, and sister-in-law, Joyce Siddons. Ruth Ann Maugham, September 6, 1936 to February 15, 2021. Ruth Anna Maugham, 84, of Cedar Falls, passed away Monday, February 15, 2021, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, Iowa City. Ruth was born September 6, 1936, in Iowa City, the daughter of John and Minnie Withoff. She attended country schools and graduated from Washington High School in 1954. An RN, she graduated from Mercy School of Nursing, Iowa City, in 1957. On June 22, 1958, Ruth married Dr. John Francis Maugham at the Presbyterian Church, Washington, Iowa, a marriage of 62 years. Ruth worked as a nurse at Methodist Hospital, Des Moines, in 1958 and 1959. While John interned at Broad Lanes Hospital, she then worked as the office nurse in John's first practice in Baxter, Iowa. Ruth and John raised three children. She was mom to their son, John II, and twin daughters, Laura and Linda, and her greatest joy was her family. Ruth loved music. She frequently played the piano and organ, and occasionally the accordion. Deeply interested in electronics and technology, she enjoyed being among the first to try the latest computer and gaming devices, often even ahead of her grandsons. Longtime members of Nazareth Lutheran Church, Cedar Falls, Ruth and John enjoyed after-church Sunday brunch with several Nazareth couples, including many they'd traveled with on international church groups. Ruth also enjoyed monthly brunch bunch gatherings with ladies of the group. Ruth is survived by her husband, John, son John and his wife, Diane Maugham II, daughters, Laura and her husband, Monty Bowden, and Linda Maugham, grandsons, Nick and Natasha Canada Maugham, Christopher and Marcy Bowden, Reed and Emily Bowden, Michael and Megan Bowden, Braden and Caleb Bowden, great-granddaughters Destiny and Willow Maugham, and Winley Bowden, brother Eldon Withoff, and several nieces and nephews. Ruth was preceded in death by her parents, brothers Clarence and Leonard, and grandson Matthew and John Maugham. Visitation is at 1 p.m. on Friday, February 19th, followed by a 2 p.m. memorial service at Dahl Van Hove Schoof Funeral Home, Cedar Falls. Pastor Christopher Bowden officiating, with burial to follow at Fairview Cemetery, Cedar Falls. Attendees must bring and wear a mask and practice social distancing. Online condolences may be left at www.dahlfuneralhome.com. Memorial gifts will support Christian Crusaders and Gravis Foundation of America, Fresh Wind Worship at Western Home Communities. Mildred Davenport. Mildred Davenport, 81, of Indianapolis, Indiana, formerly of Waterloo, died Monday, February 8th, at her home. Services will be held 1 p.m. Saturday, February 20th at Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Service on South Street, 234-6274, preceded by an hour of visitation. Entombment will be in the Garden of Memories Mausoleum. Condolences may be left at www.hagertywyckoffgarup.com. Lenora Burry, July 13th, 1933, to February 13th, 2021. Vinton. Lenora Burry, 87, entered into the gates of heaven Saturday, February 13, 2021, at Ravenwood Specialty Care Center in Waterloo. Funeral services will be at noon on Saturday, February 20, 2021, at Von Steen Russell Funeral Home in Vinton, with Pastor Matt Hance officiating. Visitation will be at the funeral home for an hour before services. Burial in the Garrison Cemetery. Lenora Gould Burr was born July 13, 1933, in New Eagle, Pennsylvania, the daughter of Leonard and Matria Beckman Simmons. Lenora was a 1951 graduate of Atlantic City High School. On May 3, 1952, Lenora married Gene Burr in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Lenora attended the Southeastern Bible College in Birmingham, Alabama, where she received a Bachelor of Religious Education in 1959. In 1965, she received an MA in English from Adams State College in Colorado. Lenora was a high school English teacher, teaching in the Iowa public school systems for 24 years. In her leisure time, she was an avid reader and wrote poetry and many family newsletters. She loved the beach and ocean, its sand and seagulls. She had a great sense of humor and spent many hours feeding and caring for ducks at the pond. Lenora is survived by her five children, Deborah and her husband Stephen Aki, Hickory, North Carolina, Carol and her husband David Ulysses, Springtown, Texas, Sarah and her husband Mike of Iverson, Kennendale, Texas, Timothy Ein Burr, Ames, Iowa, and Cheryl DeJose, Waterloo, Iowa, 11 grandchildren and numerous great-grandchildren. She is preceded in death by her husband of 68 years, Gene. Her parents, Leonard and Martra Simmons, her sister, Sharon McDonald, Charlotte Atkins, and Major Marjorie Counts, grandchild Tommy. Van Steinhaus Russell Funeral Home is caring for Lenora and her family. Condolences may be left at www.vsrfh.com. John Richard Eastman, December 21st, 1954 to February 14th, 2021. John Richard Eastman, 66, of Nishwa, passed away on Sunday, February 14, 2021, at his home in Nishwa, Minnesota. He was born on December 21, 1954, in Waterloo, Iowa, the son of Paul and Betty Eastman. He married Dana Hogg on September 13, 1980, spending 40 happy years of marriage together. He worked many years in the local school systems as a custodian. John was known for his quick wit and easy smile. He liked to laugh and share his love of fishing and the outdoors with family and friends. He is survived by his wife, Dana Eastman, three sisters, Jacqueline Eastman and Paula, and her spouse, Kevin Swanson, both of Cedar Falls, and Mary and her spouse, Brian Trickley of Waterloo, and many loved nieces, nephews, and cousins. He is preceded in death by his dad, Paul Eastman, his mom, Betty Eastman, his brother, Randy Eastman, and one sister, Linda Gray. In keeping with the wishes of John, there will be no funeral services. Memorials and condolences can be made directly to the family. We'll hit some local sports. We've had some wrestling state tournaments. Our lead article there is Don Bosco claims 11th state dual crown. We have a picture of the Don Bosco youth wrestlers celebrate after one of their teammates won a match Wednesday during the Class 1A state dual championship match. The Dons beat Lisbon 34-25 to win the program's 11th state crown. Dons topple Lisbon in championship match to win third title in 4 years. Journalist Jim Nelson, Des Moines. Don Bosco of Gilbertville felt it let a little slip out of its grasp 365 days ago. Wednesday, the Dons were not going to allow that to happen again. Wrestling with a different level of fire and attitude than it had all season, Don Bosco captured its 11th state dual championship in program history and third in 4 years with a 34-25 win over Lisbon in Class 1A state final at the Wells Fargo Arena. A year ago, it was Lisbon that won critical matches to dethrone the Dons in a 36-30 win. We definitely knew before the duel we let this one slip through our hands last year, senior Kale Wahavari said. We weren't going to let that happen this year. We had a whole different fire coming out, and we started off big and kept rolling after that. The Dons won the first five matches to build a 19-0 lead and made the Lions chase them as each and every Don Bosco wrestler that took to the mat wrestled with a purpose. Eventually, the Dons led, grew to 31-7 before the Lions began to work their way back into it. Starting at 120, where defending state champion Brandon Paez beat Garrett Funk 6-4 in sudden victory. Lisbon then followed with back-to-back wins with Cade Steinbreck and Quincy Happel, and all of a sudden it was 31-19 with a pair of matches left. But Michael McSilland, the fifth Don senior to take the mat, closed out the victory with an 8-3 decision over Indy Hawbog at 138 that sealed the deal for the Dons. For sure, that crosses your mind, and it did, but we just told our guys to go out and fight, Don Bosco's head coach Tom Hogan said. Told them to go out and fight for it, and up and down the lineup we did a great job of by not giving up as many bonus points as we could. And that is what it takes to win a dual title. A lot of things went right today, obviously. When you win a tournament like this, a lot of things have to happen. This was the fourth time the Dons and the Lions had met in a 1A final, but just the first time Don Bosco prevailed as Lisbon had won the three previous in 1988 and 2017 and last year. Over the years, Lisbon has set the bar high, and we are just trying to set it a little bit higher, Hogan said. Sometimes we have come up out on top, and sometimes they have. To win against that team, anytime you win a title, it's sweet no matter who it's against. Don Bosco's fast starting began with Rahavardi bumping a weight and beating Lincoln Holbord 4-1 at 152. Then Cale Frost followed with a technical fall over Mathis Cole. Cade Tenal earned a decision at 170, and Carson Tenal registered a technical fall over Jamin Moore 23-6 at 182. Cedric Yoder capped off the 5-0 start with a 1-0 win over Truman Krobe. It is a pretty awesome to be a part of this, Frost said. Three titles in 4 years is pretty amazing. I'm grateful and for being a part of this team. Our next sports article is in wrestling. Go Hawks pin down 3A championship. Waverly Shellrock blows out two-time defending champ Southeast Polk, Jim Nelson, journalist. Des Moines. Waverly Shellrock had built some momentum. Back-to-back-to-back technical calls by McCray Hagerty, Jake Walker, and Luke Walker had put all the momentum on the Gohawks side in Wednesday's Class 3A state dual championships at Wells Fargo Arena. But two-time defending state champion Southeast Polk was poised to turn the tide and mount a comeback against Waverly Shellrock. It looked like that was the way it would go as Northern Iowa recruit Caleb Runyon built a 9-1 lead on Gohawk heavyweight Lane McDonald. Then Runyon made a mistake. He pulled McDonald into a crab position, and McDonald instinctively reached back and caught Runyon and pinned him in a 3-minute, 46 seconds. The victory was a huge catalyst for Waverly Shellrock, which did not look back, as it captured the program's fifth state dual title in school history, with a 59-12 thrashing of the Rams. He pulled me into a crab ride, and I posted back, turned in to him. Locked up a half, and I was not letting that go. McDonald said. I was just trying to do my job and not give up bonus points, and I ended up with a pin. That was great. Waverly Shell Rock coach Eric Whitcomb didn't see it, but he celebrated the most. I was walking down to the end of the bench to talk strategy with Coach Schwab about what they might do next, and I missed it, said Whitcomb. I just saw legs and hands in the air, and everybody was screaming. I missed the dang thing. I'm going to have to go back and watch it. But I was excited. When they slapped the mat, I was pretty excited. Lane has the clutch gene, and he pulls stuff out of his magic hat all the time, Waverly Shellrock senior Bailey Rolby said. It brought out team up, and we just kept it rolling. Waverly Shellrock has beaten SEP back on January 9th, 36-28. But Whitcomb reminded his team that it could not take anything for granted Wednesday. The Gohawks were dominated in advancing to the finals, topping Linmar of Marion 42-28 in the quarterfinals and throttling North Scott 60-9 in the semifinals. However, before the match, Whitcomb reminded his team there was a reason the Rams had won the last two 3A state dual crowns. I told them if they thought this duel was going to come easy after having beat them, we would be in a tough place. I think they took those words to heart and they were ready to battle. That is what we were asking, and that is what they gave us in a state championship win, said Whitcomb. Aiden Riggins kicked off the Gohawks title hunt in strong fashion in a battle of two of the top 152-pound wrestlers in the Midwest as he edged Joel Jurgasogi 3-2. SEP then won the next two before the three straight Gohawk technical falls. Waverly Shellrock got wins from Zane Behrens, Rollbar, Carter Fetch, Ryder Block, Caden Lankrick, and Robert Poynier in the win. It's pretty sick, a South Dakota State recruit said. It is pretty awesome for Luke Walker and I to get the job done. And we are not done yet. We got three more days. We want to go home with both championships. Waverly Shellrock had won four previous dual championships, its first in 2005, and then it won three straight from 2008 to 2010. In Class 2A, top-ranked West Delaware of Manchester flexed its muscle, outscoring its three opponents Wednesday, 189-39, to claim its third consecutive dual title. After beating Independence in the semifinals, 61-12, the Hawks beat Cresco of Crestwood, 49-21. The runner-up finish capped off a strong dual season for the Cadets, who beat Northeast Iowa rival Osage 39-31 in the semifinals. It has been a very special year, Crestwood head coach Keith Selfa said. It is our 100th year of wrestling in Cresco, so we were celebrating that. We have had seven guys down here for traditional and have been ranked second all year. We wrestled hard, gave them what we had. West Delaware has a bunch of horses. We competed. They were just better than us tonight. Osage topped Independence 39-28, as three of the top four teams in 2A reside in Northeast Iowa. All right, let's see if we can finish up with some collegiate sports. UNI SDSU set for kickoff, football. Panthers get top five showdown to open 2021 spring season. Journalist Jim Nelson. Cedar Falls. Adapt, adjust, and move on to the next play. It is a phrase that has been popular this week, whether it was Northern Iowa head coach Mark Farley or South Dakota State coach head John Steinermeier. There is going to be a college football game played inside the UNI Dome for the first time since November 30, 2019. And it is a marquee meeting. Both Farley Panthers and the Jacks have been ranked in most FCS top 25 preseason polls, and the two teams were separated by 1 point in the Missouri Valley Football Conference preseason poll in second and third. UNI, 92, South Dakota, 91, respectively. As much as the two programs have met each other 5 times since 2017, there is a lot unknown heading into Friday's 7 p.m. kickoff. Familiarity helps, but neither team having played in the last 14 months and personal losses throw a wrench into the picture. I think that is the standard for this game for both of us, Farley said. We played each other how many times in the last few years? The staffs are basically the same or very similar. But there's no question there are going to be things you will have to adjust to throughout the game based on personnel, guys each team has lost, and how they are going to start the season. Adapt. I think there is at least the ability to understand what has happened in the past as far as knowledge of each other, and we are both similar in that way. UNI running back Tyler Hoosman agrees. There is familiarity and unfamiliarity on both sides of the ball, and there will be an adjustment on the field just in terms of playing a game at full speed. Our bodies are in for a rude awakening, Hoosman said. None of us are used to being tackled right now and experiencing those full blows. I'm sure after a while we'll get it adjusted. I know it helped a lot to see other teams play in the fall and how they adjusted. We're excited. We are ready to get back to it, to compete. There are names that are familiar. On the UNI offense, there will be guys like Kuzman, quarterback Will McKevin, and wide receiver Isaiah Weston. And the kind of explosive plays those three can produce to have an impact. South Dakota State has those types of players too. Junior running back Pierre Strong Jr. has produced back-to-back 1,000-yard seasons for the Jacks. And then there's quarterback Jabor Gibbs, 6'3", 230-pound sophomore, has never faced UNI. Gibbs played in 6 games in 2019 and was 5-1 with the only loss to Minnesota before suffering a season-ending injury. He did not play in either game against the Panthers. He is an exceptional player, Farley said. He has the ability, big and strong, with great arm strength. He has all the things that make it difficult because you have a quarterback with running capability, yet you have a good passer as well, and then the size to go with it. He has all the tools to be very dangerous no matter how you play. In the end, Farley says whoever can take advantage of opportunities presented and adjust to the ebb and flow of momentum changes will win the game. That is a challenge we are going to have to overcome because you can only do so much in practice, Farley said. We have had enough practice. The speed of the game will be different once you hit the field, and you will have to quickly adapt. All right, I think we have time for one more sports story today. Let's do women's basketball. Iowa State rallies late, edges Kansas, 84-82. Lawrence, Kansas. Iowa State, 14-8, 10-5 in the Big 12, rallied in the fourth quarter to get past Kansas, who is 7-12, 3-10 in the Big 12, to an 84-82 Wednesday night at Allen Fieldhouse. Leading the way for Iowa State was Ashley Jones, who got her 10th double-double of the season with 24 points and 12 rebounds. During the contest, Jones became the 11th player in Iowa State history to surpass the 1,500 career points. Lexi Darnarski had her second straight 20-point effort with 20, while Kristen Scott also reached double figures in 4 straight contests with 18. Iowa State led 8-34 at the break. Kansas came out of the locker room stronger with Ione Kirkcowsley notching their first 7 points in the half, capping it with KU's first lead at 41-40. The Jayhawks hit 6 of their first 7 shots to move ahead by 6 at 51-45 before Iowa State was able to reel KU back in and get back ahead on a Johnson three-pointer at 55-54. But Kansas continued to make their shots, going 11 of 15 from the field in the third. Back-to-back Franklin three-pointers got KU back ahead, but Darnowski got a lay-in in the final seconds to make it 66-64, KU leading in the fourth. Franklin got a lay-in for the first points of the quarter, but the shots finally stopped falling for the Jayhawks as they went on to miss five straight. ISU took advantage with a 9-0 run, capped by Kristen Scott's three-pointer to move back ahead 73-68. Kansas was able to get right their ship and get back within one possession of 82-80. But Iowa State went to the well again as Ashley Jones converted a second chance bucket with 11 seconds left to put the Cyclones ahead 84-80. Kansas got a layup with 1.6 seconds left to make it a two-point contest again, but Iowa State was able to get the inbound in safely as time expired to wrap up the win. Congratulations to the Cyclones. And that will do it for today's reading of The Courier for Thursday, February 18th, 2021. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.